Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
In this show, we're going to dive deep into flips, wholesales, holding rentals, and creatively structuring deals.
So that we can show you how you can achieve that lifestyle of freedom that you desire. Hey guys, welcome to the Chasing Freedom Show with Noah and Jeff. Today we have one of our buddies here from the Maui Masterclass, Josh Blankenship with Springview Properties. This guy is in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and we're not joking when we say that he owns half of the downtown over there. The guy is an absolute savage, and we're going to pick his brain on how he got started in real estate and how he got scaled up to doing what he's doing now. So Josh, thanks so much for being with us, man.
Dude, thanks guys for bringing me on. Love connecting with you guys again. When we met in Maui, it was like, these are my peeps.
Yeah,
these are my people. So thankful you guys asked me to come on and chit chat.
Yeah, absolutely, man. We're stoked to have you. I remember like second day of Maui, second or third, I was like, man, I should probably like talk to other people, but Josh is so cool. I just like hanging out with Josh and chatting real estate.
Dude, I know, for whatever reason, I really gravitated to you. I was like, I'm going to hang out with this kid. He's cool as hell.
Yeah.
The bromance got real. I was about to offer you the other bed in the shared room that Jeff had. Bro, like, dude, you should just take the other bed, man.
I really appreciated Josh's perspective because, so as we get into the show, this will make more sense, but Josh holds most of his stuff. And up until the Maui Masterclass, that's when we really just started considering holding stuff. And so I really enjoyed the conversations with you because it was like, I hate conversations where people are like, oh, you're killing it. You're 27. I can't believe everything you're doing. I don't want to hear that. Our conversations, you were like, yeah, sure, you're doing well, but none of that matters right now. You can be rich, but you're not wealthy. Start holding properties. And every conversation we had was about like how to grow my business into something that is sustainable long term. And so I was like, I don't need to talk to anybody else. I need Josh to keep pushing me and keep showing me why that's the route that I need to follow. So I really appreciated that you got real with me and you weren't just one of those hype guys, because no one needs, we don't like, a hype guy is kind of important, but we need somebody to challenge us and push us into that next area.
Jeff's ego is already too big. Then
it is way too big.
What we really need is some humbling friends. We need some friends to humble us.
So true, man.
Well, Jeff reminded me of a younger version of myself, because when I got into the business, I was flipping houses, right?
Yeah.
So when you guys told me your story, I'm like, man, I know your world. Let me throw myself in off to the side. So... And I knew what it felt like 4 or 5 years into that business and just getting nailed with taxes.
Yep.
And then discovering like the why. Why the hell am I doing all this work? Yeah. Why am I cycling through properties, doing all these deals, acquisitions, sales, marketing, blah, blah, blah. You guys know the drill.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, getting half of it taken away from me.
I'm, yeah. Like,
so on the flip side of that, my accountant just told me the other day, he's like, your effective tax rate is 1%. And I'm not sure if I don't think that was after Maui. So I don't think I told you that.
But, oh, wow.
That's the difference, is like, yeah, the wealth generator that comes later is the savings on taxes of buying and holding your, yeah, properties, not necessarily selling. Now, I'm thankful for that season that I sold, you know, flipped houses, sold. We didn't even do as much as you guys are doing. We did about a house a month on average. I think it was about 15 houses a year.
Okay.
Those first 4 years of business. So.
But you never had partners.
As big as you?
I've never
had a partner.
Yeah, you're doing 15 houses a year all by yourself,
yeah,
which means you were probably locking them up. You were getting together financing. You were doing the rehabs. That's insane, because one thing I've noticed, the reason that most flippers have a roller coaster, I call it the roller coaster business,
yeah,
where they, yeah, make a lot of money and then they have no money and then they make a lot of money and have no money, is because they're single man operators who, yeah, do everything. And the issue is that they'll work really, really hard to go find a property and they'll tell everybody they're looking. Once they find that, mm-hmm, one house, they flip it. And for 3 months, they're not looking for another deal. And then they're 2 weeks before listing, yeah, their current flip.
They,
and they're like, oh my gosh, I don't have another project. Yeah. And then they have a 2 or 3 week lag before they find something else. And then it's another month to close it. So the fact that you're able to do 15 a year all by yourself is actually, it's like super impressive.
Yeah, that's solid.
When I was in that business, I always tried to have my next one under contract when we started a renovation on one, right?
So, yeah,
I always had that rollover. But yeah, you're right. Most guys that are getting started, their life schedule looks like the acquisition cycle of their business. And it's, you know, you got to pull yourself out of that. Obviously, you guys have built a team around it. You're killing it. But yeah, it's fun. Fun times. I mean, I didn't have a clue what I was doing
early
on.
Just winging it.
No systems. Throw the business on my back. I'll carry it.
Yeah.
I'll, you know, I'll do the acquisitions. I'll do, you know, I still have my real estate license.
But. Yeah. Which is fun for about a year. Yeah. And then you're like, no, I'm done with this, dude.
Or less.
Yeah. Or less.
Hey, before we dive into your first deal, can you break down a little bit more on the taxes that you just talked? You said your effective tax rate is 1%. So one, break down what effective means, like effective tax rate. And then two, why is your effective tax rate 1%? Because that's, you just hit us kind of with like this gold nugget, and now we want to know more.
I'm gonna throw in your disclaimer here, guys. Josh is not a CPA, so take everything he says with a grain of salt. I got you, bro.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I am not a CPA, and I didn't know what effective tax rate was until my accountant said, your effective tax rate. And I said, what the hell is my effective tax rate? So I will tell you this, that we have, see, at the time that I had this conversation, I had 120 units.
Yeah.
I don't know, the cash flow is between 20 and 30, 25-ish a month. I got my tax bill, my office manager got my tax bill. So we lined everything up. What do we owe? I owed like, I think the Fed $8,000 or something. And might be reversed. I might've gotten $8,000 back from the Fed and the state. I owed $8,000.
Okay.
And I owed like a few hundred to local. I was like, my office manager, who makes $40,000 a year, paid more in taxes than I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, I'm sold.
Yeah.
Like it, you know, so that's one example. But, and then I have another deal we're doing right now that is just crazy good deal and completely tax free.
Yeah. So it was your tax rate so low because you're able to cost seg those units that you own? Is that the strategy that you guys are doing?
We have done a cost seg, but it's not, I don't even think it was in the year that I'm talking about.
So okay.
This was for 2019. We're working on 2020 now. We always seem to file in October.
Yeah, same here.
Anyways, I don't like it that way, but the last 2 years has been that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I can't really give you a great answer. I'm not a CPA.
Yeah.
My great answer is go find a really great CPA that understands real estate.
Yeah.
So my wife's family is in real estate, and they basically threw me into the CPA that I'm working with now. So
yeah, I can share a quick little story that kind of reinforces that. Find a good CPA. Noah and I just switched our CPA because the CPA that we were using was not a real estate expert by any means. So this month, I get to write an awesome check for my taxes from last year for about $82,000. That freaking sucks. That was using the wrong CPA. All of my flip profit came in as flip profit. There was no depreciation, no strategies used or anything. Now we had our tax strategy meeting. Like, it was just our intro meeting. And we're already with this new CPA who's a real estate specialist in our market. And now we're holding stuff, which allows us to do cost seg and these cool depreciation bonus stuff. And we're meeting with him and we're going over what we have right now. And he's like, if you guys don't buy any more long-term assets for this year, your tax bill will maybe be about $20,000 a person, maybe 30 worst case now. But if you can go and buy another, it was like $1.5 million to $2 million worth of real estate, then we can use that to cost seg and then get our tax bill down to like zero. So that's the difference of like the bad CPA. I literally have to write an $80,000 check. So this year I'm making four times what I made last year, and I will pay worst case 20 if we don't go and get aggressive and try and find a $2 million asset this quarter, which we're going to, and then we're going to pay zero to $5,000 in taxes. So that's the benefit of having a CPA who actually knows what they're doing.
Yeah. I'm on the phone at least once a week with my CPA.
Yeah.
So you want to look for someone that's going to be willing to actively tax plan with you. And not just be reactive, like, oh, what happened last year? Let's send over the reports.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a totally different perspective, and it's the way it has to be done, really.
Yeah.
Once you get into.
Absolutely. Cool. Well, Josh, let's jump into what got you started in real estate? Kind of where were you at before you started flipping houses or whatever your first step was? And then what motivated you to get started in real estate and take that jump into doing that?
So I went through college painting houses and paid my way through, you know, basically owning my own job, but made enough money. I haven't had a W-2 since high school. So
nice.
But I did basically have a job, just worked for myself, painting houses in college, and got married, met my wife, had our first kid, basically had a crisis at 25 years old that I was not on the path to like fulfill any of my potential that I knew I had. So, I had a long season of like searching and praying and like really going after it. Like, God, what is my next move?
Yeah.
Cause it ain't painting houses. I'm not going to do this the rest of my life. But yeah. I had no financial education as a kid. Like, we were not a financial home, blue collar. So I didn't know what I was looking for, but I was looking for something.
Yeah.
And eventually I met a girl that was flipping houses in Nashville.
Okay.
And actually my father-in-law was coaching her, and she wanted, her name is Brittany Turner, by the way. Any Nashvillians, she's in Nashville.
Nice.
You probably know who Brittany is. She's a baller, developer, Ariel Holmes, shout out.
Nice.
So she took me under her wing and she started mentoring me. We went down to her properties and toured her job sites, and I was like, caught the fire. I was like, this is the vehicle. I know it is. So I went home literally like the next week, was in classes for my real estate license.
That's awesome.
Just jumped in to like learn the market, was driving for dollars, listening to Bigger Pockets, like when that was like 2012, 13.
Oh, nice.
I started listening to them. So like, you know, first few episodes.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of the story of how I found real estate. And did you want to hear first deal? Is that what you said?
Let's real quick. I want to recap that, cause I find that this is a recurring theme on our show, is that we just had relation. I guess you guys just found out we had Heather Blankenship on the show like 2 weeks ago. And she has a similar story where she got the fire and literally like she's driving across the US, stays at an RV park. She's like, oh, this is cool. By the time she gets to the West Coast, she is under contract to buy an RV park. Like people what I find is a reoccurring theme in successful investors is they get the itch, they get the fire, and then immediately they take action. And it's not like, oh, you were like, oh, I want to invest in real estate and you went and bought a house. But you got back, you learned a little bit, you got back and you started taking those courses and listening to Bigger Pockets. Taking action it's so mind-blowingly simple, but so many people don't do it. Like when you get that fire, don't let that fire diminish. Like take action right away and then things will start to come from that action. So you went and got your license. What happened after that?
Well, my mentor, Brittany, she advised that we go to this like guru seminar. So me and my brother-in-law, who's in real estate sales now.
Nice.
Went down to, I think it was close to Cincinnati where I'm from. And we did a 3-day, her name was Robin Thompson, the queen of rehabs. Nice. If you guys ever run.
No.
Awesome. Anyways, I got some like formulas.
Yeah.
To give you the 70% like, rule.
Yeah. Like 70%, 65%. Like, and with that one equation, I flipped like what, 60 houses.
That's brilliant.
Like,
yeah.
Like it cost me $1,000, my brother-in-law $1,000. So, you know, we were on just a sharp learning curve for that first year, like just learning our market, learning how to flip a house, what adds value, what are the levers you pull. So I didn't find a house, a deal. I got my license in mid 2012 and then didn't get a deal until January. Didn't sell my first flip until January of 14.
Okay.
So 2 years?
Took 2 years.
Yeah. Nice.
Did it take 2 years because of a minimal amount of action being taken on a daily basis? Or did it take 2 years because it was such a steep learning curve for you?
It was such a steep learning curve. I didn't know what I was looking for to begin with. I thought I did. So I was just driving literally every day, taking in as much education as I could. Making offers, we got our real estate license, we started touring houses, you know, all the whole thing. But no, every day I I went to work, and even though nothing was happening, we were driving neighborhoods, cold calling, doing sheriff sales, foreclosure auctions, the whole thing. I mean, back then there was a lot more REOs than there is now. So that was actually became a pretty heavy part of my strategy. But no, it was not because of a lack of effort. It was a complete inability to identify a deal.
Yeah.
So now, after you walk through a couple hundred homes and you do this every day for a year, dude, you start smelling it.
Yeah.
Like, you can see it on the MLS listing. You can see if the buyer or the seller is motivated before you even talk to them.
Yep.
Just by the how the listing is laid out, what the description is, who their agent is.
Yep.
I mean, usually I know now. Now I'm like, back then it was a shotgun effect, right? You're just shooting in whatever direction you can with as wide a spread as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a sniper game. Like, I can smell a deal a mile away and know before I ever go call an owner or if this is probably going to work or not, if we have a chance.
Let's dive into that a little bit, because I think that's huge. So you had to become an expert in your market to then be able to identify things so quickly. Yeah. I think that's huge. And that's one of the reasons that we've found success in our market is, like, you can tell me a neighborhood and the stats on the house and I'll know back end value. I'll be within like 10 to 15 grand on back end value and then I'll go digging. But we get deals because who gets sent the deal? Like, we got one in Nampa, Idaho the other day, and I'm driving back from showing an investor a different house. I see the text from the realtor says, hey, this is going on market right now. If we get an offer over in like the first 15 minutes, I think we'll get it. Literally look at the address. I'm like, 219 all day. Let's buy it. And we got it, and they got seven other offers over our asking price an hour later. We locked this thing up within 15 minutes of being on market, and it's going to be an easy little flip for the company because we were an expert in that market. So talk about what you did to become an expert in your market and why that's such a crucial or an expert in the asset class that you're in, or whatever you want to kind of dive into what you focused on and how that's kind of blown up your business and allowed you to find success, especially in like individual deals.
Well, in the early days, you guys talked about having a real estate license and like not liking that or not thinking that's a major asset. I have 100% and think in the early days, you should get your real estate license because it gives you speed. I don't have to call my agent and wait on him to like get done with his four listings or showings or whatever he has going on, or even get out of bed.
Yep.
To come open a door for me. Like, I can call as soon as a listing pops up, I get an email and we have a wide variety of, automated emails like everybody does.
Yeah.
So as soon as something pops on, I call the agent, get a code. I'm driving.
Yep.
I don't care when it is, especially those first few years. It's like, if I was like 2 hours away on vacation or whatever, which didn't go on vacation the first few years, no matter what it was, where I was, what I was doing, I was out the door touring a house.
Yeah.
And speed became my best friend.
Right? Yep.
You can, if you're first to get there and you know how to sell yourself as a buyer.
Yeah.
You know, you can get a lot of good deals like that.
Yeah.
Speed wins very often. So it's,
speed wins, especially if they're motivated, right?
So yeah.
You're dealing with motivated sellers.
Yep.
And if they're motivated, speed absolutely is your friend.
We had an agent trying to kill a deal. He was the listing agent. We were already under contract, and he's sitting there trying to kill the deal because he's pissed that his clients took our offer 45K under asking. And like, I'm like, dude, like, they wanted to take it. We were quick. That's how it goes. You can't be mad about it. Your job is to advise your clients on what's best for them, not what's best for your commission. But it doesn't always go that way. And, you know, again, we were the first one to make an offer. We got it significantly under asking, which cut his commission, I'm sure, by a decent amount. So he was pretty upset, but speed is king.
So one thing that I would do to like have that not happen is, a lot of times, especially with foreclosures or low dollar listings, I would always put the offer. I would write it up because I was an agent, and in buyer's agent, seller's agent section, I would put the seller's agent in both sections, both sides of the commission to them, and send it over to them in a nice little envelope. And they open it up and they see their name on both sides of the commission just served up to them. They're like, what do you want it for?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Having those guys, we've used that strategy a lot where we've just given over the commission. And even now we have an in-house agent, and what we do is like, it's a split with us. So he gets his 1.5% of the buyer's agent commission. And then our 1.5 normally just gets rolled over to the listing agent. So then they're not getting the full 6, but they're getting 4.5 and our guy's getting 1.5. And so it allows us. But so real quick, you said two things. You said speed. And then the other thing is knowing how to present yourself as an effective buyer. Go into that a little bit. What did you do to position yourself in the eyes of that seller? Because really, like, I think people get tricked into thinking that price is the most important thing all the time. And that's just simply not true. Like, ease of transaction and comfort are two things that people are highly motivating things to then accept your offer. So what did you do to position yourself or come across as a very serious expert buyer on some of those deals?
I think it depends on what kind of seller you're dealing with. But I live in a pretty small market, right? So, and my wife's family is pretty well known in the area. Okay. So like, he was a pastor and businessman. So a lot of people knew who he was. So I would always play what I call the Mennonite game, which is the small Mennonite community. So who are you related to?
Yeah.
Oh, your second cousin is blah, blah, blah. They know this person that I know. And you just build that connection. And that's because that's the culture.
Yeah.
So just understanding the culture, which was foreign to me because I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio, bigger city.
Yeah.
Coming to a small town, and it's like small town gossip.
Yeah.
But so just learning the language and building rapport in whatever way, I think once we started doing deals and having a reputation as a solid buyer, always, presenting yourself as a professional.
Yeah.
Yet relaxed and local.
Yep.
Is often appealing, especially the guys that hold, there's a lot of old business guys in the area that had commercial properties that were just sitting for years too. So we picked up some of those, and that came through relationships too. So I think the number one thing would be relationships and rapport building.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a generic.
No, I think that's good. I think one of the things you said is like, it's like a scale, right? Like, you want to come across professional, but not too professional, because then you lose that local. And in some markets, it doesn't matter. Like, if you're in Southern California, they don't give a crap. Like, have the best offer, be professional. But Boise's a rather small market too. And being the local house buyers, it helps us get deals. Like, it helps us get owner carries, being the local guys who can make you more money on your money compared to like giving money to the bank. And so I think that's something, I just wanted to rehash. I think that's huge, is understanding that balance of like, yeah, you can come across professional, but also make sure that you're coming across as local and relatable as well, because that's if that's your market, that'll help you close the deal, right? Having that rapport and building that relationship.
Yeah. And I think, okay, I will say the number one thing is just asking a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
To a seller, because you can tour a property with a seller who's ashamed of how it looks. Their brother was in there for a year and he just destroyed it. And he was a hoarder and he had three dogs that crapped in the back room.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable, as you guys know, what you run into in this business.
Yeah.
But so touring and being sympathetic and asking a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Gives you the ability to craft your offer.
Yeah.
To craft the rapport building in a way that brings the best results.
Absolutely.
We call that
it's a win-win.
It doesn't sound very good, but we call that salt in the wound. So you have to find out what stings, right?
Yeah.
And then you find out how to solve that sting. So how can you wash the salt out of their wound? I think that that's like the number one thing that we're like honing in on with our sales guys right now.
Yeah.
Is if you can't find urgency, if you can't find that there's a reason that seller has an urgent need to sell and they don't have motivation, then we move right to price. If price doesn't work, it's a dead lead.
Yep.
But if they don't have urgency and they don't have motivation, but the price still works, we'll still make it happen. It's just that deal takes a little bit more skill to make work, right? But one of the things that I really liked that you said was knowing the market that you're in.
Yep.
So we had some guys that were competing with us on the TV commercial. We do a TV commercial, and
which is brilliant.
They started before us, so they had the head start. They should have killed it over us, right? Yeah. Like, you're the first one to air. Now we look like copycats.
Mm-hmm.
They were gone within 90 days.
Yeah.
Because they missed a key factor. In Boise, if you See, I even just said it wrong. So if someone's listening to this podcast, I just lost credibility.
We are not Boise. We are Boise.
Boise. In Boise. Boise, if you mess up a street name, Jeff did this one time with the seller.
Bro, I got cussed out.
That lead was gone within 3 seconds, and who knows? It could have been a good deal. We'd never know.
He knew instantly you didn't know the neighborhood.
Yeah, yep. I mean, I was like, bro, this is an old like Native American
he
name,
messed
though.
Up on a Native American
it's so
street.
Hard to
and
say.
The guy was like, you don't know history?
The guy was legit. Have like, it was worst case scenario. He was a professor of like Native studies, and so he was like, you don't know this tribe? This is one of the most important tribes in American history. And I was like, oh, okay, it's done. Bye, later.
So like now, like, but like on the TV commercial, we say we're the local treasure, what do we say? Treasure Valley house
local
buyers.
Local Treasure Valley house
because
buyers.
Because Treasure Valley is something the locals call it. Yep. And then anytime we hop on a call with somebody, the first thing the guys are trained to do is they find a landmark. Like, oh, you live over by Settlers Park right off of Kootenay? That's awesome. I drive past there every single day. It's a street name,
Settlers Park is literally
not
even in Boise. It's in Meridian on Eustick in Meridian Road.
It's fine. I'm just giving an example. But anyways, like that's what we do. And so what are some of the things that you did?
Noah, you need to drive for dollars more.
No, I know. I don't do the driving for dollars.
No, I will say Noah's really good at like on Google Maps in a call, like finding something real quick and be like, oh, you live next to so-and-so? And I'm like, all right, good. Even though you don't know it super well, you're good to like get on.
You don't have
to
know.
Yeah, just know how to use technology right.
But once you start, like once you know a neighborhood or a certain area of your city and you start buying and your signs are all over the streets and then people are calling you, you instantly have rapport, right? But then you know that neighborhood inside and out. You know how the backyards connect. You know where the alleys are.
Yep.
You know how the trash trucks what their routes are, you know? So when those conversations do happen and you are in the trenches like that, it's instant credibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now I don't do all that stuff because I know the neighborhoods, you know, that there's a season that you have to go through where you're literally in the dirt. You're in the trenches. You're walking neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Like there's, once we bought a couple houses in a neighborhood, like I would just walk it.
Yeah.
Like I'd bring my wife and kid and dog way over to the other side of town, get out and just walk that neighborhood, you know, just to learn it, just to know the neighbors, get to know people, whatever. But
when you say way over to the opposite side of town in Chambersburg, is that like 5 blocks, 10 blocks?
Just a subdivision across the street.
I'm just kidding. I actually think you have like a similar population to us.
Boise's got to be bigger. I don't know. Maybe.
What do you guys have?
40,000.
Oh yeah, we're way bigger.
Yeah. But surrounding is like 80.
Okay.
We were really flipping anywhere in the county, not just in our little town.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, let's jump into what you're doing now, because I actually like your social media. I love the stuff the projects that you post. One, I think, I don't know if you design them, if your wife does or something, but whoever does, kudos on the design. Like they're always super modern, fun looking. Well, let's talk about what you're kind of doing now, because you're not flipping single families. What have you moved into and what do you love about it?
So do you want the progression or do you want like right now?
Let's go progression. What attracted you to that area, and then kind of explain what you're doing now and how it's going.
Okay. So we simply transitioned from single family flips to just keeping those single families as rentals, buy and holds. And then we moved into small multi. I mean, it's like the normal progression.
Yeah.
Just as big as my vision could get, I wanted to go.
Yeah.
So we did some 5 to 10 units, 12 unit, 24 unit. And these are townhomes or apartment mixes. And then we started buying in our downtown Main Street core district, which is a lot of first floor commercial.
Okay.
You know, retail, restaurants, offices, insurance offices, nonprofits, whatever, just anybody using these commercial spaces.
Yeah.
And then above, there's always two floors of apartments.
Nice.
Usually the whole main core district is 3-story buildings.
Okay. Nice.
And there's a lot of buildings that were the two commercial. What we found out was like, as we started buying and really narrowing down on this asset class of mixed use, commercial residential.
Yeah.
Was that the commercial was leased out, storefront street level was quote unquote, you know, functional, but the second and third floors were vacant. No, the apartments had been abandoned, you know, just poor management or whatever it was. So we started buying vacant buildings, anywhere from typically 5 to 10 units.
Okay.
Completely vacant buildings. And then as we talked about off screen or off recording, I think, we're building out a system now of just how you flip a house, right? So, you know, you're going in, you're doing your gut, then you have your process. Mm-hmm. Doing the same thing with like a multifamily mm-hmm. structure with yeah. commercial and residential apartments. So that's where we're at now. And we've received development awards from the, you know, local government. I'm just now been invited to be on the board of it's called Chambersburg Area Development Corporation.
Oh, nice.
So we're going to be able to be with the most influential developers, bankers, landlords, like all the movers and shakers in my community.
That's awesome.
I'm going to be at the table and be able to see where investment dollars are coming in the future. Like,
that's huge.
Be at the core of it. Yeah. So
you walk down the street and people are like, the downtown developer, there he is, cheering and throwing rose petals at your feet.
Yeah. It's always warm invites.
Have you seen the TV show Yellowstone?
Yes.
Are you like the downtown Pennsylvanian John Dutton dude? Like, you just got to run the show, or what?
This is very much exaggerated, but, the guys, my GoPod and GoBundance, they call me the mayor.
Yeah, I love it.
It's just hilarious. But
you're winning at the Monopoly game, man. Just 100%. All the buildings on Main Street.
So it is like real life Monopoly, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of freaking fun. Because we're trying to buy up our whole square right now. We have half of it, and I told you we're
that's awesome.
And I'm going for the one next to it. We're about 40 grand apart right now. So I'd have about a little over half of this of our main square. And then we have been focusing our development efforts on the one block north of that, which has historically received a lot more money and attention, and the retail is a lot nicer.
Yeah.
And then the one block south of there, which is, as you move south, it gets more ghetto and ghetto.
Yeah.
Right? So
I'm sure you've gotten this question before. I'd imagine in being in groups like GoBundance and stuff, you get challenged a lot. Do you have any fears or reservations about having so much money tied up, or in whether it's your money or not, or so much debt or so many assets in one localized area? Does that worry you at all? And what do you do to combat that? Or like, what's like your contingency plan, I guess?
Cash flow is king always. When you're buying a distressed property or whatever, it's exactly like a flip. It's just on a slightly bigger scale.
Yeah.
You just got to know what your rents are, break down by unit, what your construction costs are, and then get a little more detailed on your evaluation up front. But
yeah.
But I learned a lot of good lessons from the flipping days that translate now into this type of development. It's all the same lessons, whether it's design, as you noted, and or construction, deal making, cold calling sellers, meeting with sellers. I mean, it's all the same. It's all those skill sets from flipping houses. And
yeah.
Right.
These days are,
Can you take us through a specific deal? I want to know how you found it, what that negotiation looked like with the seller. You know, were there any terms? Were there any specific things you had to work out? Were there issues? What you thought rehab was going to be like, what it ended up being like, the exit plan for the building, which for you was probably get it occupied and get it renting, right? And then the refinance process, if any, and then how the asset's performing now. Like, give me like the full storybook on maybe like a recent acquisitions.
So, okay, there's a couple different ways to do this, right? And I've learned the smart ways to do it and then the way you shouldn't do it. So the one example is it's a 10 unit building, 2 commercial, 8 apartments. They're all efficiencies. I bought it for $200,000 and put long-term debt on it right away. It was like a 10-year fixed rate, 15-year mortgage. So okay. I went pretty aggressive on the pay down on this one.
Yeah.
And I try to stagger all my loans differently with long-term fixed rates, of course, so that my renewals aren't all happening.
Smart.
Like, I'll get 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, even if those cost me more, all my stuff's not, because we're buying all the time and refinancing all the time, all my stuff's not coming due, like boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Right. So we're staggering all of our fixed rate periods. Anyways, so back to the 10 unit, because I structured it long-term up front, we then went out of cash flow and just one by one renovated these apartments. Right.
Mm. Okay.
So it took about a year to do this building.
So you really bootstrapped this one.
Yeah. So this one was self-financed out of cash flow, which is a whole nother conversation on like structuring your business and construction.
Yeah.
And how it's funded is so important because it affects how fast you go and where you go.
100%.
My coach has helped me navigate through some of that stuff. How I was just like not structuring for a long time the construction costs of my business correctly.
Yeah.
But I digress. So we fixed up this whole building, 10 units. It's now worth $475,000. Okay. I had about $7,000 to $9,000. So let's say on average $8,000 an apartment. There's small efficiencies.
Okay. Oh, nice.
So you're $80,000 rehab?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then plus another, so let's just say $100,000 across the whole building.
Yeah. You probably had exterior work and
exterior commercial
space downstairs. Units, yeah.
Right. Which weren't big rehabs. So anyways, the numbers work, but I'm not going to refinance that one.
Because you already have 10-year, you bought it up front with a pretty decent loan product on it.
Yeah.
Right.
Which means it probably wasn't totally distressed or vacant, correct? Otherwise you would have.
Oh, bad. This is one of the worst
really?
Ones.
Really? So you
it
got.
It was just a terrible slumlord that I bought it from.
Okay.
He was just never treated for bugs. I mean, it was bad. But I bought it for $20,000 a unit. So it was like the cash flow was incredible. The rents at the time were all around $500 a piece. So it was $5,000. We're now on average about $800 a unit.
Wow.
That's killer.
Renovated. So right under $1 million value on
right.
my property. But I'm not going to refinance it, which is the lesson, right? If you know you have a value add property going in, let your bank know not just like buy it on the cash flow existing.
Yeah.
Let them know what the value add is, of course. And now we're getting the same type of assets. We're getting loans with 12 or 18 month interest only periods that allow us to save money during the construction period and then know that we're rolling it back into a long-term debt product that, you know, and getting all of our construction costs back out of the deal.
Yeah. Are those ones that you just mentioned that you're doing a 12 to 18 month interest only? Is that like a linear loan product that you're using? So it's the same folks giving you that 12 to 18 month interest that is doing the long-term financing?
I've done it both ways. Mainly because one banker just pissed me off, so I went with another bank. But typically, it's always the same bank, knowing that they're going to get the refi out in the back end to put up with you for the interest only period. So you kind of build that bridge. Interesting. No pun intended.
Yeah,
yeah.
But
it's called a bridge loan. Yeah,
it is an actual refi product that you're doing though. Same bank, but it is a refi product.
Or is it a rollover product?
Because the rollover, you could recapture your construction costs, but you're not grabbing any of that equity gain, right? Whereas in the refi, if you've created that value add additional equity, then in a refi, you can get your construction costs back plus any additional equity that you've created up to the 75, 80% mark.
Yeah, it's a burr.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're doing the refi rate and actually pulling out equity out of the deal? Or you just recoup it. Yeah, okay.
I mean, there's a million different structures you could do here.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We're just curious.
For the most part, yeah. So, okay, let's run through just a couple.
Yeah.
One is you have private money and you're buying these assets cash, right? Which you can often get the best deal. And then you pay for construction through, I don't care how, whether it's your cash, another investor's cash, doesn't matter. And then you just go to a bank for a cash out refinance. Yep. You get your construction money back. Your lenders get their money back plus interest. Everyone's happy. We're in a long-term debt product.
Yep.
The other way is you put 20% down and you get a bank loan with interest only, which we're doing more and more these days. For the longest time, I didn't have the option buying traditionally because I didn't have 20% down.
It's expensive, yeah.
Yeah. especially if you're buying every month, like that runs out really
fast. Yeah. Yeah.
And we were using our own funds for construction. So I was always broke for the first, I mean, I'm still broke.
Yeah.
We're rolling stuff so fast.
Yeah.
Any cash that comes in the door usually is the 20% equity down, you know, for a new purchase, or yep. it's paying for construction or whatever. But anyways, the what we've been doing recently to build liquidity and reserves and a pool of money that we can use for construction on these big value adds is only pulling the cash out that we need, no additional equity, but then getting a second on the property for a line of credit.
Nice. Mm. I like that.
And then as we do these properties, we put a second, the bank will refinance them.
Yeah.
Only pull out as little cash as you need, and then put a second on the property.
Yeah.
And then you keep doing that over and over and over again, and each property gets the same. It adds to the line of credit every time.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yep.
So you're building a line of credit as you refinance through these properties.
Yeah. I like that.
That's creating a liquidity using the equity that we build. So it's net worth, you're building wealth, but you're also able to tap into that wealth if you need to fund construction or whatever that cost is.
Yeah.
So is that a cumulative line of credit? It's not like you don't have like 20 different lines of credits all with $10,000 to $20,000. You've got one cumulative account.
Because you're
one line of credit, and as we refinance out, they just add collateral and increase the line.
Yep. So you're doing that all through the same lender then?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. I like that.
This this 10 unit with the commercial underneath that you're walking us through, how did you acquire it? How did the property come to you, or how did you find it?
So the guy that owned it was is an engineer, and we were using him for some drawings at the time.
Nice.
And he was like, oh, I got the, you know, he just went through like the dread of owning this thing. And I'm like,
yeah.
Dude, show it to me. Let's see what you got. And it was bad. Like, it was really disgusting. That like the bug problem was like a third world country. Like I've never seen before.
It was,
they had duct tape, like rolled up backwards, so it was all sticky, right? And then just like strung around the walls to like catch cockroaches as they.
Oh my goodness,
dude!
So I walked in, I was like, we were at like 250 based off cash flow or whatever, and that was a good deal, knowing it was distressed. And then I walked back through it, and I'm like, dude,
I need 50 grand for the roaches, bro.
Yeah,
that's incredible. We bought it's funny, it's a 10 unit. We bought a 10 unit here that we're renovating. And I remember when the first time I walked it, like since I had kids, I've gotten more emotional, but I walk in this house and I just like, I'm like, oh, I got to get out of here. And I walk out and I just go to my truck and I was crying. I'm like, how was somebody this much of like, I've seen some other area. Like this is not like an impoverished area. This is just a freaking slumlord who didn't do anything to this apartment. You literally have like electrical wires on a hot water heater, like 2 feet away from your freaking shower head. Like, people could have been dying and no care is given. And I was just like, man, I can't believe that stuff like this exists in like a non-impoverished area. Like, Nampa, Idaho is not like a ghetto area. It made no sense. But anyways, so you go in, it was 250. You see the roaches, you see some other stuff probably. You use that as a negotiating tool to then get your price down to 200.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We walked out and I just looked at him. I was like, Lance, that's terrible, man. Like, what am I going to do with this? Like, I don't know if I want it, first of all.
Yeah.
So it better be a good deal. Like, I think 20 grand a unit makes sense. So that's where we landed. And he had zero leverage because he knew he was just, slumming it up.
He didn't take care of it. What did you say you thought the back end value was now? Are you basing that on a cap rate, or are you just basing that on the improvements and comps?
Yeah, based on like a 10, I think it's like a 9 I applied to it, because it's just because of the area it's in isn't the best. So even with a higher cap sale, it would be just under $1 million, like 475 is where I have it.
Nice. Yeah,
that's really cool, man.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, hey, we're getting close to needing to wrap this up. We always end the show in the same way. What kind of podcasts or books are you listening to or reading that you would recommend to somebody else?
Right now, I'm rereading Think and Grow Rich.
Okay.
It's a good one.
Classic, right? The big, if you're trying to figure out how to scale your business, The Big Leap is a great book.
Yep.
Can't tell you the author's name. I'm terrible at names. That one's amazing for the insight of like when you hit new levels of success or happiness or love or anything good in your life, and you always like self-regulate and bring yourself back down to whatever level in that area of life that you think you deserve.
Yeah.
So it's like they call it upper limiting. When you hit an upper limit,
okay,
you kind of self-sabotage or recorrect. So just being aware, when I read it, it was like my mail was being dropped on me. So
yeah, I like that. You told me about that one in Maui. I ordered it. I haven't got to reading it yet, but I have a copy at home. It's on the list.
It's great.
Yeah, I like that. I think that definitely happens, right? Like sometimes we don't think we deserve the success we have, and so we'll do subconscious things to sabotage our own ability to get to the next level.
Yep.
I think that it's real.
Once you identify those things, because sometimes it's very subtle.
Yeah.
And you don't always catch that you're self-sabotaging. Maybe you're coming down too hard on your employees because it's freaking you out that you have so many employees or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then they end up quitting and you're like, they suck.
Yeah.
But really, you're unwinding the thing on yourself.
Yeah.
So there's all these nuances and you don't always catch it. But once you get the principle of like upper limiting and self-sabotage or self-limiting, it's a powerful thing that you can't unsee. So yeah, it's good.
I actually got my phone out to write that down because I want to go read that. It sounds good.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. And then podcasts. What about podcasts? What podcasts you listen to? What podcasts have helped you get where you are?
So along the freedom vein, my business coach's podcast, Mike Ayala, is Investing in Freedom. And I actually just had a podcast with him come out today, which is cool. And
nice.
I get to record with you guys.
Nice. That's awesome.
So his, obviously, BP. Let me think. School of Greatness is great. I don't know.
I like it, man. No, that's helpful.
Yeah, normally, people just go Bigger Pockets.
Yeah, Bigger Pockets. And then your coach's podcast, what was that called again?
Investing for Freedom.
Investing for Freedom. Okay, cool. No, those are great tips of advice for the listeners, man. Cool. How can people get a hold of you? I mean, you've got a really cool story. You're doing a very niche thing in real estate, which you're developing your downtown, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I'm sure people are going to want to reach out and ask questions. How can they get a hold of you?
Social media is as good as any. Instagram is Josh_C_Blankenship. And then Facebook, Josh Blankenship. I'm not super active on Facebook. Try not to be as active on Instagram either. But
yeah,
I should up my social game. Anyways, our website is rentspringview.com. Yeah, that's it.
You want to give them your physical address so they can show up and ask you questions?
Just, not cool, brother. Just go to Chambersburg, walk to the downtown. Like, odds are you knock on a door and Josh owns it. So,
well, brother, thank you so much for coming on, man. It was really fun to get to talk to you and dive a little deeper into your story. We appreciate the advice you shared with everybody, and we're looking forward to staying in contact with you. Hopefully, we'll see you in January for the ski trip.
Absolutely, guys. Thanks so much for having a chat.
Absolutely, brother.
Appreciate it, man.
Good to talk to you, man.
See ya.
All right, guys, thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Chasing Freedom Podcast with Noah and Jeff.
Please subscribe to our YouTube channel in the show notes below. And if you ever want to get a hold of us, feel free to do it via our Instagrams. You can also follow us for our funny content on TikTok.